today I'm presenting some findings from a research project that we conducted at Continuum, the Centre for Widening Participation Policy Studies, where I work with Professor Storin, who I'm sure you all know, as well as Tony Hudson and Nicola Stevenson, who probably sold you more raffle tickets than you wanted to buy last night. I know she got me. And this piece of work came out of talks that we had with Linking London Lifelong Learning Network. I'll refer to them as Linking London in the shorthand. And this discussion centred around e-resources, e-learning. And we were discussing the fact that even though we weren't using the terminology, that a lot of particularly younger learners who are moving out of schools and into further and higher education what Prensky call digital natives. This technology, or these technologies rather, now are so ubiquitous that a lot of younger people have naturally just grown up with things like the web and, of course, smartphones, social networking and such. And Prensky posits that educators have slid into the 21st century and into the digital age, but are still doing a great many things the old way. It's time for education leaders to raise their heads above the daily grind and observe the new landscape that's emerging. Recognizing and analyzing its characteristics will help to define the education leadership with which we should be providing our students, both now and in the coming decades. Times have changed. So too have the students, the tools and the requisite skills and knowledge. So this was really kind of the starting point for this very small scale investigation, really a snapshot of the type of e-learning resources that Linking London partner organisations were using. Now, at the time of research, there were 25 Linking London partner institutions. If you'll excuse me, I'll just read through the list quite quickly. Birkbeck University of London, City University, London Met, London South Bank University, Middlesex University, SOAS, which is the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, the University of East London, University of Westminster, and a number of further education colleges who also have higher education provision, Barking and Dagenham College, Barnett College, City and Islington College, City of Westminster College, Kensington and Chelsea College, Lewisham College, Newham Sixth Form College, Southwark College, the College of Haringey, Enfield and North East London, Hackney Community College, Tower Hamlets College, Westminster Kingsway College, the City Lit, and also three small adult learning specialist institutions, Morley College, the Mary Ward Centre, and the Working Men's College. I feel like I'm accepting some sort of award and having to thank everyone with that. Now, the Open University is also a member of the Lifelong Learning Network, but I'm sure you're all familiar with the Open University and their distance learning provision. Because they were such an unusual institution, we didn't include them in the research. Now, e-resources was a term that Linking London kind of provided us with. They wanted a snapshot of the entire gamut of kind of tech innovations or e-resources, e-learning resources, but also e-resources for management administration. So we define this in the very widest sense, including virtual learning environments, different software platforms, research software such as SPSS or InVivo, other e-resources like Web 2 technologies, social networking sites, mobile phone and audio-visual technologies. And we defined e-resources as they related to not only learning and teaching, although that was the main area of interest, but also how they're used for administration, management, capturing student data, so on and so forth. So really quite a big task we set ourselves. Now, in terms of methodology, I'll just quickly run through that. Necessarily, we used mixed methods. We used an online questionnaire, a lot of expert and stakeholder interviews, a lot of documentary analysis. We developed a couple of case studies of particularly innovative practice. And we triangulated all of that with online sources, prospectuses, institutional web pages, so on and so forth. Through the online survey and in particular the phone interviews, we obtained over 40 responses. Each institution was represented by at least one or two responses. And I do have to point out that it was interesting for a piece of work around e-resources that our online questionnaire was so spectacularly unsuccessful. Out of 180 emails, potential emails that we sent out, we received 18 responses, and most of those were from UEL. I don't know if I strike fear into the hearts of my colleagues, but I suspect, you know, because we were based at UEL, that they were very kind and responded. So we had to kind of use more traditional research methods and actually pick up the phone on this one. So, but I liked the knowing looks. I'm sure you all have had similar experiences with online surveys. Great when they work, but not so good when they don't. Now, our findings. We found, and I'm sure that this doesn't only apply to London, but actually I think probably fairly indicative of the national picture. We found that within the HEIs, the FECs, and the sixth form and specialist colleges that we looked at, there was excellent provision of a wide variety of technologies and e-learning resources. However, this does not necessarily lead to blanket use of these resources. And in fact, we found that the use of these resources was very unevenly spread within institutions, and even within academic schools within institutions. We also found that there are good support structures in place. We all have IT service departments, colleagues there running around very busily, resetting my password nearly every week when I forget, and maintaining the networks and so on. However, we found that these IT service departments generally were not supporting the most innovative use of these types of technologies. And we found that the most innovative use of e-learning resources came from individual academics who could be seen, I suppose, as e-learning champions and was not, in fact, service-led by IT. So that was kind of really our main finding. Obviously, we found that e-resources are used daily by staff in all areas of their work. Realistically, no one can work in one of these institutions without at least checking their email on a daily basis. So we found that these technologies really were heavily embedded in day-to-day practice. We also found that there are many areas of good practice and innovative use of these resources for admin, marketing purposes, as well as teaching and learning. For example, at UEL, we use a lot of mobile phone and texting technologies that come from student services to inform students about deadlines, examinations, and to advertise the variety of student services that we offer. We also found that there's a considerable amount of research done, particularly in the higher education institutions, on the implementation of these technologies and how they affect learning and teaching, how they might affect student progression or achievement. But we found that our academic colleagues in these institutions were more likely to write up their research, publish in journals, and speak at national or international conferences rather than disseminate their findings through their institution, which was interesting. We found as well that these days all the institutions we dealt with in this piece of work have some sort of approach to e-learning. Many of them have a formalized e-learning strategy. Some used to and have moved away from that because they've embedded e-learning in their other learning and teaching strategies. Some have e-learning committees. Certainly all have some personnel who are employed as e-learning leaders. And the organisation of this varied widely between institutions that we looked at. Sometimes, or sometimes there were e-learning committees that were kind of a centralised committee. Oftentimes we had smaller e-learning committees within academic schools. So there were kind of formalised structures everywhere, but the way these structures were organised and worked were very different between institutions. We also found that all institutions, even the small specialist institutions, offer staff training on a wide variety of technologies, audiovisual technologies, commonplace things like Microsoft Office, research software, things like that, but all offered staff training. For the most part, the staff training was not compulsory, and staff just went along to these sessions. Interestingly, we found that there were two areas in particular that were widely used and widely embedded in all institutions, and these were the use of social networking and Web 2.0 technologies and virtual learning environments. VLEs weren't a surprise to us, but when we looked at the level of social networking use of these institutions, we found that finding quite interesting. So we'll start with social networking, and I have to point out that this is kind of social networking plus Web 2.0 technologies. Now, every single institution we looked at had a very strong social networking presence on sites such as Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Most had actual channels on YouTube set up, or at least audiovisual content on the website. And again, this varied from video presentations of lectures, conferences, to marketing purposes and short films around student services and things like that. All institutional web pages allowed the user to follow updates on a wide variety of RSS newsfeed applications as well, and this held true for HEIs, for FECs, and for the smaller specialist institutions. We asked the question, do any of your staff use social networking resources for learning and teaching? We found that 79% said yes, they do. So not only are these social networking technologies being used by Linking London partner institutions for marketing purposes, there is a lot of innovative and pioneering use of these technologies for learning and teaching. However, again, we found that this work is conducted by a minority of academics and tutors within different schools, is often not supported by centralised IT service departments, and this good practice is not well disseminated between even subject areas within schools, and certainly not between academic schools. These e-resources are more often than not being used by highly IT-literate staff who can be seen as e-resource champions within their institutions, and these staff are not necessarily the same personnel that are involved in e-learning strategies. So although most institutions use these e-resources, the types of social networking tools used in partner institutions did vary. For example, there are a lot of Facebook pages for specific subject areas, specific tutorial groups. Unfortunately, we didn't have the resource, it was kind of outside the scope of this particular research, to talk to learners and academics as to why they would be using Facebook rather than their own internal VLE. But I suspect kind of the popularity of Facebook would have something to do with it. It doesn't seem like work, I guess, to learners to log into their tutorial group through Facebook. Also, a lot of VLE use in wikis, online wikis, as informal learning sites, and obviously for the dissemination of course-related information. So that were kind of the more popular uses of these social networking sites. But I'll present one case study that we worked up, and that has to do with Second Life. Is everyone familiar with the online environment Second Life? Many are. Good. Second Life is the internet's largest three-dimensional user-created virtual world. It kind of had its peak in popularity a couple of years ago. We found that two Linking London partner institutions had a presence. One was Middlesex University and the University of East London. Because it's my own patch, I'll go into the way that UEL uses Second Life. Some years ago, we set up UEL Ireland, and we delivered information, advice, and guidance to prospective students through this virtual world. So, using it for marketing, I suppose, purposes as well. But I think the more innovative use of Second Life, really, that UEL does is for learning and teaching. Within our School of Health and Bioscience, we set up, or colleagues over there, set up virtual laboratories for training health and biology students in lab methods. So they would conduct their practical laboratory work in a virtual environment before they even set foot in the real-life labs at UEL. And what was found was that their achievement and grades were really enhanced by this kind of dry run in a virtual environment. In the end, Second Life was found to be, a bit exclusive, a bit clunky for students. So colleagues recreated these virtual labs using other VLEs, and that is still being conducted. Our forensic students also log on to Second Life, and they investigate virtual crime scenes online as an aid for teaching and learning and for discussion in tutorials later. Our photography students have virtual photographic exhibitions on UEL Ireland and Second Life, and I'm sure there are other other colleagues using Second Life in this way at UEL, but they're kind of the main ones I came across through this research. Now, that's all well and good and kind of good practice for one institution, but what we were really looking for as well was kind of if there was any cross-collaboration between institutions using these technologies. And we did found one example of a shared virtual learning environment. But I'll cover kind of virtual learning environments more generally. And we found that they were used, VLEs were used in all Linking London partner institutions. Two main VLEs in use, Moodle and Blackboard. I'm sure you've all heard of those. 67% of institutions using Moodle and only 33% using Blackboard. And here there was a noticeable difference between higher education institutions and further education colleges, with two of the eight higher education institutions using Moodle, the remaining six using Blackboard. We found that Moodle was so popular because it's free, Blackboard you pay for, and that's why a lot of further education colleges said they used it. The reason that so many use Blackboard is because of the Bloomsbury Learning Environment, which is a shared virtual learning environment, and it was the first example of a cross-institutional implementation of the Blackboard academic suite in the UK. Now, this is a shared platform that has been developed and deployed across all six of the University of London Bloomsbury institutions. It was established in 2003, and the three founding partner institutions were the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, the Royal Veterinary College, and SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies. The partnership now includes the School of Pharmacy, the Institute of Education, and Birkbeck College. Now this VLE, the Bloomsbury Learning Environment, enables academic staff to upload learning resources in a variety of forms, obviously, ranging from traditional lecture notes, PDFs, PowerPoint presentations, to the increasingly popular and common podcasts, recorded audio, and video lectures, and practical videos of practical sessions as well. And of course, the advantage is that learners can access these remotely at a time and a place that suits themselves. We also found that uploading lecture notes and presentations in advance really enables learners to familiarise themselves with the general content and the vocabulary of the lectures or presentations, which we found was particularly important for learners with dyslexia, learners with physical or other special learning difficulties, because they can make adjustments to the materials using screen readers, changing font sizes, and so on. So it really makes this material a lot more accessible for those learners. And of course, learners can submit electronic copies of their assignments through this BLE, which saves time and effort for them, as well as reducing the administrative burden on support staff. An added advantage of this electronic submission is the ability to use the Turnitin software. I'm not sure if our international colleagues use plagiarism software, but it's increasingly common to do so here. And of course, the Bloomsbury Learning Environment is used by staff and learners to track performance and progress for e-portfolios, and it enables learners to communicate, collaborate, and create content through a variety of tools, discussion boards, wikis, and blogs. Now, how it works is each partner college has their own individual BLE interface, which is branded accordingly, but they benefit from a single license and shared server. So there's huge cost efficiencies there in terms of the license fee, but also in terms of computer space for hosting. And it's really developed or helped to foster the development of communities of practice, not just in terms of technical support. There's a BLE technology group, but there's also a BLE learning and teaching group. And these groups come together to jointly organise events for the dissemination of good practice. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so successful, actually, is that there is a kind of an offline structure that really encourages collaboration across the colleges. And it said the success of the BLE is due to recognising and addressing the interest and needs of four key stakeholders: academic staff, developers and technical staff, research staff, and learners. And it's interesting that it works so well in this kind of collaborative way with the BLE, whereas, you know, this research really kind of found that that was in stark contrast to the way that colleagues, these e-champions that are usually embedded in particular schools within institutions, aren't working collaboratively for whatever reason. And indeed, this is kind of, I think, at the heart of the matter, is how these support structures are staged within institutions. These innovations are really led by academic champions. So without support from centralised IT services, and I don't want to criticise our centralised IT services, they're very busy, as I said earlier, just making the networks run. But what we found was, once an academic or a group of academics kind of pilot, for instance, this use of Second Life in learning and teaching, and once that's been up and running successfully, often for some years, then the IT service departments will step in and start supporting these services. We found that all institutions provide staff training. 75% of respondents had received sufficient training. However, we found that approximately 38% felt that they needed more training. And of course, the support structures from the e-learning colleagues and e-learning strategies were in place, but huge differences with how they were organised within institutions. So, moving rapidly on to conclusions, we found, which was no surprise, that these e-resources are commonplace in all areas of partner institutions, with e-learning strategies, embedded e-learning imperatives into other strategies, and either centralised or dispersed e-learning units. But we found that there were two main problems with how this was all staged. There is highly uneven skill sets amongst academic staff and a lack of dissemination of good practice. And instead of kind of disseminating within institutions. This dissemination was usually outward facing. And there was very little collaboration, not only between institutions, but also within institutions, between different schools. And of course, the Bloomsbury learning environment is the exception to that. But we did find that there was huge potential amongst the colleagues that we spoke to develop more collaborative approaches and a real willingness for more collaboration that in future will hopefully overcome these uneven skill sets and will result in better use of these technologies for the digital natives, our students. So, questions? Comments? Applause?
Applause, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
I've got one.
Yes.
Social media policies. The research asked the institutions about the social media policies that have been instigated or discussed, something we're looking into.
Oh, really? No, we didn't. No, we didn't. And that was probably a little foolhardy, because our approach was, because it was such a broad remit, e-resources, I mean, you know, in a way it would have been better, I think, to have looked at virtual learning environments, looked at social media and so on and so forth. And we didn't really contact marketing departments, and I imagine this is where, I guess, these conversations perhaps are coming from. We really targeted academic staff, student service staff, administrative staff, and library and learning resource staff. So no, we didn't. But that would be a very interesting area of to look into. What are your conversations, kind of, how is that being established? Well, and we all should.
But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, more and more of our learners are engaging with and expressing themselves using particularly Twitter and Facebook to a certain extent. And a lot of the time that's very, very positive.
Yes, and a lot of times, absolutely.
It's negative.
Yeah.
And there have been situations where a student said something on Twitter, it's been picked up by the media, something has come off and come out of it. It's happened with our teaching staff and our support staff as well. They are creating their own little sort of Twitter accounts.
Yeah.
Of course, with more and more, you know, to personal more.
Absolutely.
Work.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I would suggest that all these issues are because of this lack of centralised support. And again, I don't want to kind of criticise our colleagues in IT. They are, you know, usually overworked and very busy. But until you do have kind of, I suppose, in terms of branding, a house style for these sorts of things, and a clear policy that probably will align with, though, a more general media policy of how academic colleagues engage with the press on radio or in interviews and things like that. Interestingly, in another piece of work I conducted for a large distance learning and online learning provider, I won't name them, they were grappling with this, actually, and they were a little frustrated that their learners and their staff, again, were turning to Facebook and Twitter when they had their perfectly well-run, beautifully branded own wiki or virtual learning environment. And they really wanted control. And this was an issue around control. But our learners should be on our pages, so we can moderate the discussion. And, of course, in the real world, that is the big explosion with these Web 2 technologies, that these are unmoderated and yet public domain discussions. So I think there's tension there in all our institutions around that, and I'd be very interested to see what you come up with actually in terms of some sort of policy, because policy is all very well and good, but how do you police it as well? Can you turn around to students who are now, of course, in the UK being firmly positioned as consumers and say, thou shalt not? Well, actually, it's my spare time, it's my own laptop at home, I can and I will. So I think actually in future there will be even more tensions, and it'll be interesting to see how we all overcome those. Just out of interest, are there any other institutions kind of considering these sorts of issues yet? Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a tough one. Great. Lovely.
All right, well, we're out of time, but so thanks very much to Karina.
Not
sure
a problem.
We could actually have pursued this for several more hours. I think that perhaps the next question to go into is having determined that there are these e-learning strategies, the use of technology is throughout institutions, but as you've picked up, the key point is it's not being used well systematically.
That's right.
And I suppose the key question is, so what do we do about
it? Exactly.
Anyway, thanks very much to Karina.
Thank you.
Lovely, thank you. And we'll hand over to Neil for the second half of the workshop on the East Midlands STEM project.
Yes, so my name's Neil Raven. I manage AIM Higher in East Midlands, and I guess what AIM Higher in East Midlands does is to coordinate and manage a range of projects that cross county boundaries, because a lot of AIM Hires are arranged around local counties. So what we do is coordinate projects that cross those boundaries that are actually regional in their scope. And one of those is the East Midlands STEM, so Science, Technology, Engineering, Maths Awards. I'm going to start calling them EMSTERS, okay, but that's what that stands for. So if I start, I'll try to minimise my use of these kind of short phrase things. What I'm going to do is outline the project to start with. The project's been going since 07, so it's 4 years now. It's coming to a close now, so we did think it was a good opportunity to do some evaluation. So we did an evaluation, and I'll report on some of the key findings from that evaluation. And then I'll look at the kind of application of those findings, because up until then it's going to be a bit retrospective. It's looking at what's been done. But I guess this is where it chimes into this idea of legacy. It's what the lessons, what can others learn from this, what can we take forward from this scheme now it's coming to an end. Okay, in terms of the kind of dimensions of the project itself, as I say, it started in 07. It was funded by the Regional Development Agency, and it was in part a response to government initiatives to enhance regional economies. So there's a kind of regional dimension there. It was organised by us, AIM Higher in East Midlands, and it was also supported by the 9 universities, if you include 10 universities in East Midlands, including Northampton. And it was also supported by the local AIM Higher teams as well in each county. Now, the reason why we concentrated on STEM was that a lot of government reports in 06, 07 suggested that STEM, there was a lack of students progressing to STEM. STEM was underrepresented in HE in terms of numbers. And that was true in East Midlands, that was true nationally as well. So there was that need to focus on STEM. So it started in 07. And we had 2 cohorts. The first one started in September 07, that was 69, so there's a total of 200 awards were released, so 200 award holders. And then the remainder, which was 131, started the following year, so we had two cohorts on the go. Now, the promotion was through schools and colleges, carefully targeted. It was also through our AIM Higher contacts as well, so they would know the kind of schools to target, because it was a WP initiative. In terms of selection, that was quite rigorous. So to get a scholarship, to be entitled to one, young people, but also mature learners, so including mature learners as well, had to be on EMA, so Education Maintenance Allowance. If not, they had to have family or household incomes of less than £30,000. So it's quite rigorous, as I say. In addition, the award holders, potential award holders, would need to register on their UCAS applications that they were going to do a STEM subject, and also to do one at a East Midlands university, because of the kind of regional remit of our funders, the Regional Development Agency. The scheme itself had two main components. The first one was a scholarship of £1,000 a year. Okay, and this was divided up within the year into three equal instalments. Now, the idea behind that was it would act as an incentive in terms of retention, keep them going, keep them on, if they were going to be entitled to the full sum. The second element was a skills event, and that was an annual event that was held at various regional conference centres across the East Midlands, normally kind of February, March time. And the idea with that was that it would have helped to equip the award holders with the skills they would need post-graduation. So CV writing, how to stand out from the crowd, interview techniques. There's also lots of networking, so we've got companies, local companies to come along as well. We got them to find out about opportunities for postgraduate study, also industrial placements. And so it's quite a dynamic one-day event. And I've got some pictures, I think. Yes, I have. Of last year. No, it's this year. We're still in this year. This was February this year. It's obviously the last of our four conferences. It was held at Ford College, which is at Loughborough University. And that's just a kind of entrance with a, I assume it's a Ford car in the right-hand corner. I say, a lot of these events consisted of lectures, but also workshops. And this is an entrepreneurial workshop, entrepreneurial skills workshop. I remember because I was attending. We also, by year four, had already had one cohort, the first cohort, graduate. So we got one or two of them back to give their insights into life in the real world 1 year on. And this was Richard, and he did a presentation on this kind of how he'd got on since graduation, what he'd learned. So it's kind of feeding back. It became almost a virtuous circle, if you like. Interview skills as well, so we had mock interviews going on throughout the day. They're quite public, actually, so the photographer could just in the middle of a foyer, but if they can cope with that, I assume they can cope with an interview in more private surroundings. In the final year, due to feedback, we also decided we would have a panel discussion. So what you have there are a panel of former STEM undergraduates from all over the place who had returned to give pearls of wisdom to the audience. So we had people from PricewaterhouseCoopers, people from Land Rover Jaguar Land Rover, I'm never sure of the order, accountants and so forth. So and that proved quite successful. And of course there was a careers fair element to it as well. So it's quite kind of dynamic entities, really, these skills events. Now, as I say, seem to have disconnected. Oh no, here we go. Evaluation. As I say, it's coming to the end now. The first cohort's graduated last year. This current cohort is about to graduate this year. They might already have done so, slightly early. But it's coming to an end. So we thought it would be a good time, good opportunity, to actually evaluate the scheme, to assess how well it's done. And we thought we could do that by looking at three key elements to the programme. First of all, access. Has it had an impact? Did it have an impact on access to HE? Second, did it have an impact on retention once they're in HE? These are kind of key issues, key WP issues. And third, did it have an impact, positive impact on progression post-graduation, so what happened after graduation? And what we were aware of is that originally a lot of WP activity, learning participation activity, was focused on access to HE, but there are still issues once they get into HE. I talked to a colleague in Sweden, which is true there, isn't it? In terms of retention, there's still a kind of retention issue. And then do they have the social capital to make the most of post-graduation life? So that's what we tested it out on. Now, our methodology was mixed as well. So we used interviews, semi-structured interviews with all the cohorts. We also did online questionnaires, online surveys. We actually got quite a good feedback, but we did offer inducements. So that's the reason why, I think. Okay, in terms of access then, what was the impact? As I say, 200 scholarships. So in kind of crude numerical terms, you could say that we've got 200 more students from WP backgrounds who've gone on to STEM degrees and so forth. That's slightly misleading, because we did find, due to the timing of the program, we did find that quite a few of the first cohort had already started to apply to HE when the grants came online. But what we did find was that getting the grant actually had an impact, or the potential to get the grant had an impact on the final decision to progress to HE. So you've got a quote there. Probably wouldn't have been able to do my course without the award. Okay, so that's another quote about kind of conversations in the family over finance, and the fact that the EMSTA scheme made that decision possible, made that progression possible. So that was very positive. Move on to retention. As I say, we had 200 scholarships on offer 4 years ago. And what we're likely to see is that 196 of those, that's 98%, will actually graduate. That's a high retention rate. That compares quite favourably with kind of standard WP retention rates. And the students kind of confirm that in their kind of qualitative responses.
Yeah, sorry, quick. So the 200 that received a scholarship,
yeah.
All 200 of those applied to university,
yeah.
And all 200 of those were offered a place at university,
yeah. Yeah.
And all of those that had started their course,
yeah. Well,
and then four,
yeah,
for whatever reason,
yeah. Yeah.
No.
68% of award holders felt that it made a difference to how well they actually did on their course. Now that's in part because it released time, so they didn't have to spend quite as much time doing part-time study. 77%, I mean, remember it's only 200, so I mean, I don't know how else you do it, but it's a small number. 77% said it made a difference in terms of their confidence, and also in terms of the fact that they're quite determined to complete. Now this is important when you're looking at WP students, learning participation students, because often the confidence is lacking, they don't have that kind of background. So that was quite key. The fact that somebody actually believed in them, as that quote suggests. 63% also said that it made a difference to their enjoyment of the course. We should have asked why, because I keep thinking, why would that make the money? It might have released, I think it might have released their time, so they could have belonged to clubs and joined clubs and societies. Now, is that important? Well, it actually is in terms of social capital. They're actually participating more fully in HE than they might otherwise have done. So the enjoyment can actually be very important in terms of retention rates as well. Moving on to progression. 86% said that the scheme had made a difference. They had become more aware of STEM-related careers as a consequence, and mainly as a consequence of the event itself. So that was important as well. And the fact that it had enabled them to upskill or acquire skills that would be useful in terms of going into the real world. In terms of also networking, so as I say, we had lots of companies come along, got involved, and I think that networking opportunity was also important. Also in terms of kind of continued study post degree as well, because I think the new frontier in terms of wider participation is actually going to be a postgraduate level. Okay, so that's kind of, it's all very nice. It's coming to an end, oh dear, which is a real shame, actually. But are there any lessons we can learn from this scheme that could be of use to others? I suppose the first one, and no surprises here, is the importance of partnership working. I mean, this is the thing that's always, anybody that's been involved in AIM Higher is aware of that, that actually AIM Higher acts as, or we did act effectively as brokers. And I think that worked on two, well, probably on three levels. First of all, partnerships between us and the local AIM Higher areas and their schools and colleges. What that enabled us to do was ensure that the scheme was properly targeted. It also meant that we managed to get to students across the entire region, even in the most far-flung parts of the region, like Lincolnshire and Northampton. Northampton is far-flung parts.
We're used to it.
In addition, I think, it was also the links with the HEIs, because the universities helped in administering the scheme, helped to keep tabs on how the students were doing in terms of their progression. And if I were to run the scheme again, I would kind of develop that link even more strongly, so we could see how they were progressing in a fair amount of detail. And perhaps most crucially of all was the partnerships with the local businesses, with the CBI, with STEMnet, with the Women into Science and Technology Agency, with EMDA, with a whole raft of external agencies. They were vital to the running of the conference. We didn't pay them. They just came along. Now, was it out of the goodness of their hearts? I don't think so. Well, it might have been. I don't even think it was because they necessarily recognised our WP remit, although I'd like to think it was. I think the fact is that the scheme chimed with a lot of different agendas. So the CBI were interested in skills and the regional skills dimension, hence their involvement. Range Rover, Jaguar, Mars, some of the big companies, they have a kind of social responsibility angle. They have also an educational aspect to them as well. So I think that chimes with them. Then you've got some of the National Space Science, STEMnet, that was a STEM angle. And then you've got some other agencies that did the WP aspect appeal to them. But I think it was a whole combination of things. And it's only kind of after the event that's really started to sink in. Why was it we got such a lot of support from so many different groups? And it is because we managed to ring a lot of bells, meet a lot of different remits. The other thing about the partnership angle that has become clear, and is quite intangible actually, is the personal contacts. The reason why we managed to get CBI to come along was that somebody knew somebody in the CBI. The reason why Mars came along was that Ella, the coordinator's sister, works in Mars. And you kind of start to think, actually, it's all these kind of informal links that have been built up over the years, which are quite intangible, unless somehow they're downloaded, they're likely to go with AIM Higher Girl. So that partnership working was important. Also, the relationship we built up with the beneficiaries was key as well. And that was two-way. That was kind of feedback. It wasn't just us telling them. It was receiving feedback from them. And we constantly evaluated the program to the point where each of the events was revised and improved on the previous one. You know, we had the same audience for 3 years. So you've got to make sure it's evolving. And also meeting new agendas and being topical. So that was in part through the feedback mechanisms we developed with the students, which I think is important for any kind of WP initiative, and to remain topical as well. So when the CBI's report came out quite recently about skills and the dearth of skills, we made sure that somebody from the CBI was there to give a presentation And the students felt they were getting a bit of inside knowledge that way as well, because they were telling them exactly what they needed to do to become that much more employable. And I suppose the final thing was, and this I guess links with the two papers, was we attempted in a very kind of amateurish way to harness some element of social media. Now I think if we were doing this again, we would make much more use of that. But what we did was set up a Facebook account. We did that thinking it would be a one-way system of communication. We would be telling them. But the thing is, this Web 2.0 is two-way and getting feedback. And what we effectively, after a while, just left it and let them do it. And what you find as they start to build up their own virtual communities and self-help groups as well, not only virtually, but also small groups of them with the events, they get to know each other and they end up supporting each other, which is quite crucial. So I think the kind of media can help support that as well. So they were the three big things. I suppose the other thing is just to say the continued relevance. I mean, this is a model, again, it's arguably had its time because it was regional. And very unfortunately, a lot of regional architecture is falling away. Regional development agencies, a lot of regional university associations are, but it doesn't mean it can't be, it's scalable in the reverse. It could be more localized to one or two institutions collaborating rather than a regional level. And I think a more local model might also have the advantage of bringing the actual award holders together a bit more frequently than once a year. We also know from the panel of Fair Access that they're quite keen on the idea or this kind of concept that universities and colleges working together with schools and also employers can help to enhance access to the professions. Now that's the model that did that, and that predates the Milburn report. And the final thing is, STEM is still an issue. At the moment, I think only about 16% of undergraduates are studying STEM courses, according to the CBI. Again, to meet current demands in terms of restructuring the economy and so forth, you need about 25% going on to STEM degrees. So there's a gap still there. That's it. I do have a preemptive. I have questions, but I'm quite happy to take questions before that.
Thanks very much. Thanks
for that. That was a really kind of insightful reflection on the regional project. The question I'm going to ask may not be one that you're able to answer.
Oh, that's right.
It kind of comes from where we are at the moment. Right. I mean, I'm really conscious of the lack of sustainable funding, and I guess the key word is around sustainability. Of the 200 awards that you gave, you talked about two approaches. So there was the financial element, and then there was all the support, building social capital. Yeah. If you were asked which of those was the most influential, horrible question.
No, that's, I mean, we could have almost asked the students that. I mean, at the time, initially they would say the finance, but over the years it was the event itself. And the event didn't cost so much. I mean, it was, you know, if it's held on university sites and so forth, and if you've got the goodwill of lots of external agencies, the costs are quite modest. It's the organisation that it takes. But over time, I think it's a skills event. And I think we could do this again in a year's time, and ask the next cohort, the second cohort, what they thought. And I think they'll come ring true. I think they'll say it was the event. That's the thing that's really equipped us, and rather than the £3,000.
Because it goes on to the formation of the group, doesn't it? That support group.
Yeah.
As you were demonstrating through the social networking site. And I suspect that would be quite a key factor in what they then go on to do in terms of employability.
I mean, I think it's really key that One of the things about the approach that we've been taking is that since the beginning of having to report on access and WP, we've looked at the WP as being the whole student life cycle. And therefore, you know, there's no point in getting in if you then can't hold on to them. You're not doing anybody any favours, especially the students. And one of the key things, I think, that a lot of institutions, a lot of people in FACE have been talking about for several years, is how you get students who are from non-traditional participating backgrounds to have that social capital, to have that, you know, internal confidence to be able to manage their own learning experience. And what, you know, what we've been trying to do all the time is to put in place sort of support mechanisms which are externally imposed to try to get students to take on that internal responsibility. And I think that, you know, what that skills event has done is to show another way of doing exactly that. But it's a one-off event, and then the students sort of take the ball and run with it. And to my mind, that is the reason why you've got 98% retention on this project, which isn't just, you know, comparing favourably. It's actually wiping the floor with most of our WP statistics.
Good question. Can you tell us a bit more about what the university did in terms of supporting students once they got there? I mean, at Brunel, we run the professional mentoring scheme for 60 WP and students, linking them with professionals in the sector that are aspiring to work in. And we know that helps build the confidence and connect them with the social capital that they feel they're lacking. Sort of range of things that the universities have been involved in to maintain that high retention.
That's interesting, because we're looking at it from an external viewpoint. So the event we organise, and we kind of got all these workshops on. So the bit that's missing, you're right, the bit that's missing is, what were the universities doing? Did their support systems complement what we were doing? And I don't know that we know the answer to that. They should have. I mean, we did have a steering group that consisted of key individuals from each of the participating HEIs. But that only met during the early stages of the development of the project. That didn't carry on once it was clear the regional development agency weren't going to come back and give us more money. But I think it would have been, sorry, I'm not answering your question, but I'm just thinking through the fact that it would have been good to know exactly what the universities were doing, besides actually giving the money out and monitoring progress and getting them to attend, you know, giving them a friendly prod to attend the event. But whether their activities...
I mean, I think the answer is, therefore, a negative. What they weren't doing was taking a consistent approach to those particular cohorts of students, because you've got 10 institutions receiving, you know, those 200 students, so the little pods of them are going to each institution. Yeah. And they won't have been getting the same treatment, that's for sure.
Right. And just another point, I mean, you can't underestimate the value of the money. Not just on the day-to-day things, but as an investment in something that they do not want to lose. And that enables a high attendance at events and what we would call career development workshops. It's their investment in their own future at that point, knowing that there's more money to come at the end. And I know with some of our students that that would be a high motivator to attend these beneficial events and get the benefit.
And also, yeah, I think you're right. Also, what we did was to make it clear that they had done really well to get the award. So it was recognition of their kind of academic ability, and I think that was quite important as well. That kind of raises their confidence.
But
is
the connection to the evaluation? Did you look at the kind of support that they were receiving?
Sorry, I didn't.
Is it conducting the evaluation? Did you look at the kind of support that they were receiving from your family?
No, we didn't. I suppose we could have. We could have asked them. That's a kind of difficult question to. All we know is they came from WP background, so they came from areas of socioeconomic deprivation and so forth. So the traditional model is that they probably wouldn't receive the kind of support that others would, or they wouldn't have access to the kind of information that those in more affluent backgrounds might.
Can I just add a point about that? we run a networking workshop, and networking skills tend to look outward. But part of what we were trying to convey to our students was to look in their families. They're often totally unaware of the resources in their own networks, family, community networks, in order to help them with the challenges they face ahead. And I think that's a really good question. We need to track a bit more about their understanding of family networks and how that's used in more advantaged families.
Yeah. On that note, it's certainly we are down to coffee time, so thanks again, Neil.